Good afternoon and welcome to Senate Judiciary. I want to assure everyone my health is okay. I just went for a run and that's why I look the way that I do. So, nice color, everybody. Today we're going to continue the testimony with the eight HJRs, and we're going to begin with Attorney General Hardy Marsh. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Bryant, members of the committee. For your record, I'm Hardy Marsh, Attorney General, and I'm pleased to be here today at your invitation to the Department of Justice to present Department of Justice recommendations as to possible amendments of HJR 87-94. The recommendations that we're going to submit to you flow from a careful review of the measures by a team of departmental attorneys who will be presenting our views in more detail to the committee. And they're with me today, Special Counsel Mark Gardner, Assistant Attorney General Tim Sylvester, who is the Department's Chief Criminal Appeals Lawyer in the Appellate Division, and Assistant Attorney General Jeff Van Valkenburg and Cam Wood of the General Counsel Division. The Department has reviewed the measures primarily mindful of its responsibility to advise the legislature as to any state or federal constitutional issues that are presented by measures that are being considered, as well as our responsibility to defend measures that are approved by the people, or in the case of ordinary legislation, by the legislature, if a measure is challenged in court. And with those particular responsibilities in mind, we have examined the measures primarily from these standpoints. First of all, clarity. Striving to avoid ambiguity or uncertainty, creating uncertainty on the part of public officials, including, most importantly, I guess, judges and working prosecutors, uncertainty among the defense bar, uncertainty among members of the public, especially victims, as to what the measure means. We've certainly scrutinized them from the standpoint of the consistency of the measure's wording with the actual intention of the sponsors. And, of course, we have sought to examine them, again, with the institutional role in mind that I mentioned earlier, from the standpoint of assuring compliance with any applicable provisions of the Oregon or United States constitutions, including any federal statutory law that would have a preemptive effect. And our constitutional review has focused primarily on compliance with the separate amendment requirement of our Constitution as interpreted in the Armada case, which was the decision you'll recall invalidated ballot measure 40 in the first instance, as well as from the standpoint of our provisions dealing with amendments versus revisions of the Constitution. And that distinction, as you may know, bears on the vote that is required in the Assembly to refer the measure. Two-thirds vote being required for a revision, distinct from a majority for an amendment to the Constitution. Now, we prepared more extensive amendments in the course of the consideration of these measures on the House side. We presented them on a more informal basis through committee counsel. We were working to see if in trying to bring some consensus around revisions of the measures as between proponents and others. A few of the changes we proposed were adopted. I think it's fair to say that probably the vast majority were not. I don't think they were at any time voted up or down by the committee, and some number of them made their way into or influenced the shaping of minority reports that were prepared. Though we took no part, as far as I know, in instigating or in preparing minority reports. Those were done internal to the legislature. So, we still believe, however, that there are very significant drafting and legal issues which the versions adopted by the House have not yet resolved, and which we think it's important for the Assembly to address. So the amendments that we are presenting today do not replicate all of the proposals that we had in the process on the House side. They are intended to provide what we believe are the essential changes that are still needed in the measure so that we can, if they're referred, engage a policy debate about them, which can occur free of issues of either their meaning as much as possible or their issues of their compliance with Oregon or federal constitutional provisions. Now, these amendments, no more than those that we had in the process on the House side, these are not intended to frustrate a referral of the measures, but to enhance the quality of the measures, and in turn, I think, to permit an enhancement of the policy debate if the measures are referred. If no referendum is ordered, I believe the measures will come forward again as initiatives, with no opportunity for the Assembly or the Department of Justice, for that matter, to participate in trying to ensure that they present the intended policy choices as clearly and cleanly as we can develop them for purposes of the public's consideration. So that is the backdrop, Mr. Chair, members, of the proposals that we are going to be submitting to you. There are some proposals we submitted on the House side that we are not resubmitting to you, and a number that we are. My colleagues will be speaking to most of the joint resolutions that for which we have proposed amendments. I'm going to confine my remarks to just one of them, and then they will pick up, if that's agreeable to you, Mr. Chair, and pursue the others. Not all of the joint resolutions before you do we have proposed amendments for. The joint resolution that I wanted to specifically address was House Joint Resolution 89, which deals with the issue of the composition of juries in Oregon. This has been an issue of considerable interest to me since my own service in the legislature. It may not be a well-remembered fact, but 20-some years ago, we had a number of absolute exemptions from jury service in Oregon, primarily various occupations and professions that had managed to convince the legislature, either alone or collaborating with others, to excuse their members from the obligation to serve, and it included, if I could just take a moment, it included judicial officers, civil officers of the state, of the United States, attorneys, practicing physicians, dentists, optometrists, chiropractors, osteopaths, Christian Science practitioner, naturopath, veterinarian, or undertaker.
Who's the lobbyist for the undertaker? I want to hire him.
Now, Mark Gardner, my special counsel, was chair of the Judiciary Committee, and I was speaker in the 79 session when we passed legislation to repeal all of those exemptions. And that, I believe, has remained the law since then. And I trust I'm not the only lawyer in the room who has been called for who has actually served for the year. to note just the effect of that one judicial. So, the recent history of this policy issue in Oregon has been towards inclusion, expansion, broadening of the sharing of the obligation, at least as I view it, to participate as jurors in our justice system. Now, the reason why I think that the exclusion based on registered voters or non-registered voter status is objectionable is that I really don't think, Mr. Chair and members, that status really has any bearing on one's qualifications to serve competently and appropriately as a juror. I think that's going to hinge on other personal factors. And I think that the question has to be examined, how does that particular exclusion fall with respect to socioeconomic or other characteristics but I don't believe that's the purpose of it. I believe the purpose is perfectly good faith purpose. Who, looking at it from a different angle, if we consider a trial by jury as the trial of one's peers, who are the peers of unregistered voters? If their fellow ranks are not permitted to serve on juries, criminal juries at least. So it's really my hope that we are resubmitting that proposed amendment, though it was not accepted by the House. Given the House vote, which has put the House on record in supporting both the submission of the exclusion of registered voters, non-registered voters, and of felons from criminal juries, my alternative recommendation to you is that you divide those two issues, that you generate yet one more joint resolution and permit a referral of the issue separately so that the people can consider and debate the question of the felon status and the question of non-registered voter status independently of each other. Because one doesn't have to vote for one exclusion in order to get the other. And I believe that would be a principle. If it's otherwise your judgment that you wish to accept the House position that both issues should go to the people, I think that would be a principle resolution of the way to allow both to go, but in a way that will assure an opportunity to debate them separately, because I think they raise significantly distinct issues, policy issues. Those conclude my introductory remarks, Mr. Chair and members, and I'd be happy to answer questions, but otherwise I would like to, if I could, Mr. Chair, begin with our review.
Senator Courtney has a question for you.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised, Mr. Attorney General, you do not seem to be prepared to discuss, given the fact that you're a very learned legal scholar, whether or not we should be using this approach to make the legal statements. That is, we heard some remarkable testimony yesterday from Chief Justice, former Justice Peterson, law professors, et cetera, about the fact that to amend the Constitution in these particulars is not, it needs to be seriously studied. It appears to be from your testimony that that is an issue you do not choose to really get into as to, aside from whether or not someone should be a registered voter or not to be a jury, or serve a jury or whatever, do you choose to use the attempt to amend the Constitution to accomplish that versus a statutory authority, statute, I mean, in the passing of law? Is it basically you're not going to get into that heavy discussion? You've already indicated you think it'll be done by initiative, and maybe that's why you're just going to move that over there and leave it there. But what about that issue? That there are certain things that you just should not have in the Constitution, you should be very careful about placing in the Constitution.
Well, I think there's a fair debate about that, Senator Courtney, Chair Senator Courtney, and it's possible if you read through them, there could be a number of provisions of the range of the resolutions that one could argue are appropriately statutory material. But I don't think that decision, that analysis, at this juncture can occur in a political vacuum. As I said earlier, I think that if the legislature does not undertake to provide a renewed opportunity to consider the measures in a form which it has had a hand in shaping, they're going to be brought forward again by the initiative process with no opportunity for that participation. That's the reality of it, and I think that it would be better to have the policy debate by far with the measures in improved and strengthened shape internally in terms of their provision.
In the political vacuum, the hand of the legislature didn't have a hand in shaping. But the bottom line is, in your opinion, that means, though, they must go to the ballot. We shape what goes to the ballot. We amend, perhaps, what comes over from the House or from what the proponents want. We massage it or tweak it, whatever words you want to use, perhaps, in some cases, and as you and your colleagues will offer. But we put it on the ballot.
Yes.
That is your bottom line, Mr. Attorney General.
Yes. I'm recommending that the Assembly advance with the changes we're recommending at least these changes to the joint resolution. Now, you may make other changes. You're not the only source of proposed changes, of course, but these we believe should be made. Without these, I would not take the position I just did. But with these changes, we think that at least the measures can be brought to a forum around which the debate can occur with some greater certainty as to the outcome of the policy choice if the people make it in a certain way, and I think free of concerns about whether the measures are constitutionally compliant.
And you believe they belong in the Constitution if they're made accordingly?
I think most of the matters addressed in these joint resolutions arguably are constitutional material.
Thank you, Bernie.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. That was actually the lines of my question, too, and I want to ask this about all of these measures, whether they necessarily have to be constitutional amendments or whether they could be done, whether the thrust of what is trying to be accomplished here could be accomplished in a statutory manner. But I was concerned about your point that in the political environment, that the public expects to see something back on the ballot. Are you saying that the public demands a constitutional changes to do this, or whether the public is more concerned about the substance of what's done here?
Sure, Brian, Senator Burbidge, I don't think I can answer that question as to the form of the public expectation. But the proposal in sort of aggregate form were presented and voted on as constitutional amendments in the first instance. I don't have any survey of what the public views are with respect to what form of opinion.
But you brought it up, so I'm trying to figure out whether you were talking about the substance of what was done here or the fact that we need to do it through a constitutional amendment.
Well, I'm guessing that the expectation is that it would come in a form, that is to say, constitutional versus statutory, in which it is presented in the first instance. I don't have a survey on that, but that's my guess.
And is your sense that the public expects 8 things back? They voted on 1. And your sense is that they expect 8 back?
Chair Bynes, Senator Burdick, my sense would, I have no way to tell you any differently from that.
Okay, well then I'll go back to my initial question. Is in this particular case, of changing the voter registration, the jury pool requirement to limit it to registered voters and non-felons, could that be accomplished statutorily?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
There you go.
Mr. Chair, I have a question about the. I guess I'm generally bothered by the fact that we sort of pucker up our Constitution. I mean, the U.S. Constitution has very few amendments and really just changes constantly. I look at all of the preambles. Each of these preambles. Is it your feeling that those are necessary in each case?
Senator Duncan, I think our feeling is that it's not, as far as the legal effect of the particular measures, the larger group of amendments that we submitted for consideration on the House side, I think I'm correct in recalling, deleted that language and recast the measures in more kind of conventional constitutional amendment form. And I believe each of the minority reports presented that option as a feature of the minority report and was rejected. But we have not readdressed that part of the measures today. We have focused these changes on what we think are the remaining serious questions with the really operative parts of the measures, the really law-changing parts of the measures.
Yes, Mr. Nelson.
Yesterday we had some testimony that indicated some concern with the phrase subject to statutory evidentiary rules. And I see on your House Joint Resolution 87 in the bottom of the third paragraph, you have added that subject to statutory evidentiary rules. I guess the testimony we heard was that that actually makes the Constitution subservient to the statutory evidentiary rules. Would that phrase and that in this House Joint Resolution 87, would that have that same effect then?
Sure, Brian, Mr. Van Valkenburg is going to handle 87. Would it be convenient to go ahead and let him make that presentation?
Why don't we do this? Attorney General Myers needs to leave. If you have any questions specific to him, let's ask those now, and then we'll get into the specific elements. Are there any other questions for the Attorney General? I would like to see, I'm sure the committee would too, the other suggestions you had for the House that were broader than the ones being proposed today. So at your convenience, if you could have copies of those made for us, that would be helpful too. Any other questions? Well, thank you for your testimony, and I know we can call on you if you have others. So, Mark, I understand you're going to take the place of the Attorney General, and how would you like to begin? Just do it chronologically through the different agencies.
Senator Bryant, members of the committee, my name is Mark Darden, Special Counsel to the Attorney General. And I have the fortunate position of being the cleanup batter here, utility infielder. So at this point, I will turn matters over to Mr. Van Valkenburg.
Chair Bryant, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Van Valkenburg. I'm the Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice here in Oregon. Starting with House Joint Resolution 87, the consensus of the department lawyers who looked at this resolution was that we needed to make some technical amendments to effectuate not only the proponent's intent, but to remove some ambiguities and to lessen the risk that there would be litigation on certain points that could drag out for a period of time. The first amendments, I believe you've got the typed and gross versions, are intended where we say add the word and juvenile court delinquency prior to proceedings and after criminal in subsection 1, and again in the following line in juvenile court delinquency proceedings. Those two amendments are intended to make it clear that the substantive rights which are granted to victims in this resolution, if it's adopted, apply both in criminal proceedings and in juvenile court delinquency proceedings. We believe there's ambiguity in the current draft because subsection 1 limits by its terms the or discusses the rights and the course and conduct of criminal proceedings. Then in subsection 2, it discusses that the section applies to all criminal and juvenile court delinquency proceedings. We just felt it advisable to remove that ambiguity. Secondly, in subsection A of section 1, we thought it necessary to add the words or terms in open court after proceedings to discuss the point at which victims would be permitted or what types of proceedings they would be permitted to be heard and provide testimony. This eliminates the possibility that this particular subsection can be construed to include grand jury proceedings and in-camera court proceedings where the defendant normally isn't present, could be present, but those would be a great departure from historical practice in criminal proceedings. The third...
And then subject to evidentiary rules, are there you're intending to be the rulings of the court on evidentiary matters?
That is correct. For undue prejudice, cumulative testimony, repetition, we'd note that that was in the drafter's original resolution in 91 as relating to Article 1, Section 9. And we believe that indicated intent on the drafter's part, on the proponent's part, to include that. The last substantive amendment that we were proposing, Senator.
I'm sorry, could you raise that particular issue in the House?
Chair Bryant, Senator Brown, I'm not sure what was actually raised in the House. I know there was a number of discussions. Maybe Mr. Gardner could answer that.
Chairman Bryant, Senator Brown, the draft that we presented in the House basically was an entirely different way of approaching the amendments that are here today before you, and so we did not, I believe, address that particular point.
For either of you, then, why do you think that that qualifier or criteria need to be in this resolution?
Senator Brown, you felt it important that there be some regularity and limitation on the ability of a victim to testify in those proceedings, that it be subject to some sort of regularized process, subject to normal court procedures and judicial rulings as to the cumulative nature of testimony, whether or not the testimony was unduly prejudicial. The normal rules of evidence would apply. What this would do is to constitutionalize a grant in victims to appear and to testify where that doesn't appear now in the Constitution, but the limitation we thought important, and that it was also consistent with what was happening in the proponent's version or draft of Resolution 91.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bryan, if I might add to that, yesterday there was a comment made, I think, by the proponent, our chief sponsor of these initiatives, these referenda, that the district attorney would have some control in terms of the proceedings. If you read House Joint Resolution 87 carefully, it differs from the other HJRs that are presently before you in that this is a direct grant of right to the victim. And it's a constitutional right, and basically I don't think the district attorney has much to say about the exercise of it.
And I think after that was pointed out, the chief sponsor indicated there might be a proposed amendment to give discretion to the district attorney where appropriate, so that the district attorney would still be the one trying the case rather than an ardent victim.
Mr. Chair, our amendment does that, however, it puts that discretion in the hands of the court as opposed to the prosecutor.
Chair Bryant, Senator Brown, the final, members today, the final substantive amendment to HJR 87 that we will propose is on the second page of your material, and it would qualify and make clear that the grant of the right to a victim to refuse an interview or other discovery request or deposition is not intended and does not have the effect of limiting a criminal defendant's right to pursue by subpoena or otherwise the examination of a victim or the victim's papers or effects documents in a pretrial or trial proceeding when that purpose is for other discovery. And what our intent is there is to give express recognition in this provision to the due process rights which are guaranteed the criminal defendant in this regard. We recognize that there's another provision in this joint resolution that makes it clear that nothing is intended to reduce the criminal defendant's rights under the Constitution of the United States. We think it's better practice, better drafting, to express it in this way.
Because right now, under your due process rights, for instance, if a preliminary hearing of some sort and you chose to put on a defense, that right would guarantee you the right to look at the victim's books, records, documents, other effects, so that you could prepare for that preliminary hearing, correct?
Chair Bryant, Senator Brown, that's correct. And it also removes an ambiguity that this measure could be construed in such a way as to not permit that under the state constitution and resolve some issues that could come up in litigation at a later point.
Chair Bryant, if I might add to that answer, I think it's important to note that, first of all, this language that appears as our amendment is presently found in statute. It was part of Senate Bill 936, and it is the law presently. However, a constitutional provision will trump a statutory provision, and I think it's important that it appear, or some language. Now, the proponents, I've had private discussions with them where they are concerned about the fact that this could be used in some way to harass a victim, and maybe there's some other language or some other approach that the committee might take, not choosing these particular words. But I do think that it's important to recognize the due process rights of the defendant here, because the unintended consequence may be that some criminal charge might get dismissed because that information wasn't forthcoming.
Sir Bryant, members of the committee, if I might move on to House Rank Resolutions 88 and 90, both resolutions.
Senator Burdick has a question. Excuse me. And then Senator Nelson.
Before you move on, you did mention that the substance of this is included in the implementation measure that we passed last time. Is there anything about this, any of the rights or privileges that are given to victims in this resolution that cannot be accomplished by statutes that require a constitutional amendment?
Senator Bryant, Chair Bryant, any of this could be included in statute. Much of it is already.
Thank you.
And now,
on the second page where you're talking about the discovery that nothing shall, the subsection shall prohibit a criminal defendant from subpoenaing or examining, etc. When the purpose is other than for discovery, is that the right words?
Senator Nelson.
What would be the other purposes? I mean,
Sure, Senator Nelson, that's correct. It's for a non-discovery or fishing purpose. If there's an evidentiary reason for the defendant to require the examination of the victim or the victim's effects, the due process clause is going to require that in some context.
Doesn't that say that nothing in the subsection shall prohibit a criminal defendant from doing that when the purpose is other than for discovery?
That's correct.
I'm just reading that, I guess. It seems like it says it's backwards. And shall prohibit, and the purpose is other than discovery.
It's confusing.
It is confusing.
Chair Bryant, Senator Nelson, the resolution is drafted, couches this right, which is granted to victims as a right to refuse a discovery request. The converse as to the defendant's rights in a criminal proceeding is that they have the opportunity to obtain this when it's other than merely for discovery. When it's a substantive evidentiary reason for the obtaining of that information and examination in a trial or pretrial proceeding. I don't know if Mr. Gardner or Mr. Sylvester want to expand upon that, but I believe that's the change here.
And how does this change from current law? What could a defense attorney request in the way of discovery now?
Sure. Go ahead.
Chair Bryant, this tracks with current law because under Senate Bill 936 last session, victims have this right, and we just want to make certain that if this is put in the Constitution, that we haven't put ourselves in a situation where there are unintended consequences, because you are saying for a purpose prohibiting inquiry to the victim for purposes other than discovery, and that could be construed in the context of a pretrial situation by someone to, prohibit getting some evidentiary information that was needed. I don't know that it necessarily would, but it could.
And
I don't want to bog this down, but I mean, that's a question. And I'll just, I'm just curious, if you look at House Resolution 87, what is in here that isn't in current law?
Sure.
Sheriff Bryant, Senator Duncan, I don't believe that current law provides that the victim has the right to testify at trial. Current law, per Senate Bill 936 in the 1997 session, allows the victim to be present at various stages in the proceedings and to be heard, but there isn't a grant of the ability to testify. So that is a change.
Is that
Chair Bryant, Senator Duncan, also, I don't believe that Senate Bill 936 has anything to do with juvenile court proceedings. And so we are expanding present law, if we pass this referendum and it's adopted by the people, to cover those proceedings as well.
Yes, Senator.
I'm sorry. As I read, and I'm working off the amended version, looking at your amendment, the right to refuse an interview, I assume that that man has granted a constitutional right to the victim not to answer any questions posed by the defendant in the deposition or provide any discovery to the defendant. Am I reading that wrong? Are you saying that that isn't clearly what it says, or are you saying...
Chair Bryant, Senator Brown, I think the language says what the language says, that you know, that they would not be required to give an interview deposition to the defendant or a person acting on behalf of the defendant.
Senator Brown.
Forgive me if I'm wrong, but at least the most of the DAs I've worked with, my sense is they had a pretty good sense of when to call people for trial and who to call and which victims to include and which not to include. Mark, given your background as a trial judge, my understanding is that's what the rumor mill has, it as a lawyer, do you think that if your attorneys are not using their discretion when they're trying cases to determine which victims and which witnesses to call?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I think the practice differs widely from district attorney to district attorney. Most of them, the great majority, almost all of them, I think, exercise very sound discretion almost all of the time. There have been occasions in my career, spanning 17 years on the bench, where some haven't exercised the kind of discretion that perhaps they should. What I think, though, is missing here is the fact that this is a right that's being given to the victim. And the victim, you know, if the people decide that the victim should independently have some rights in terms of how they interact with the system.
Other questions on 87? If not, let's move on to 88.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the only substantive amendment that our office is proposing to both 88 and 90 is to expand and change the party who is authorized to assert or waive the rights established in those resolutions from district attorney to a broader concept or term of prosecuting attorney. There are instances in which the Attorney General's office acts as a prosecutorial authority under law. For example, if the governor were to remove the duties of the district attorney for a particular reason and by order direct the Attorney General to assume those duties, as has happened in recent memory in the state, our office steps in and asserts and acts as district attorney in those cases. In addition, the Attorney General's office is involved in election law violation cases as well as criminal antitrust prosecution under law. Not to mention that this, most of these provisions apply to crimes, which includes misdemeanors, and the district attorneys are generally, or city attorneys are involved in the prosecution of some of these crimes. So we thought it important to expand the term to include all the prosecutorial authorities. And that occurs both in 88 and in 90.
Looking at 88 on line 11, it talks about the right of the trial by jury without delay. And the Constitution talks in terms of a speedy trial for defendants. Yesterday I asked the sponsor about the term without delay and what that meant. What does that mean to you?
Chair Brian, I'm going to see if I can punt that over to Mr. Chairman.
Brian, members of the committee, frankly, I don't know the answer to that question. I assume I don't have any particular knowledge of why that language is put in there. I assume it's merely to parallel, I think, the right that now exists in the Speedy Trial Clause in Article 1, Section 10.
Mr. Chair?
But that says speedy trial, doesn't it, rather than without delay?
Chair Bryant, if I might.
I think it does say without delay.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Chair Bryant, if I might take a crack at that. I think that although the terms are different, speedy trial and without delay, that as a former judge, they would be found to be synonymous in terms of interpretation.
Yes, Chair Nelson.
What is the historical and philosophical reasons for not allowing the state to have the right of jury trial?
Bryant, Senator Nelson, it was only fairly recently in this state with the Supreme Court's decision in State v. Baker that our state has taken the position that the state does not have a right to a jury trial. In most other states, and in my understanding in the federal system, the government does have either a right to demand a jury trial or to veto a defendant's purported waiver, attempt to waive jury trial. We took the position in the State versus Baker litigation that the current constitutional provision allows the state to, or allows the legislature to enact a statute that gives the state the right to demand a jury trial notwithstanding a defendant's waiver. The Supreme Court disagreed with us on that. There is no, in this state at least, there is no history of denying the state in the criminal case a jury trial, if that answers your question.
What would happen if the defendant wanted to move for a continuance and the victim said, no, I want the trial to go forward? So you have two competing rights of trial without delay. Would the defense prevail because of the U.S. Constitution?
Chairman Bryant, is this with regard to the without delay clause in 88? If I recall, this is one of those that there is not a direct grant of a right to the victim in this particular provision. And subsection 3 says that the prosecuting attorney is the one with the authority to waive, et cetera. And so to that extent, if the prosecutor agrees with, acquiesces in the continuance, notwithstanding, that would be fine even if the victim doesn't check, as is currently working.
Right, but if the district attorney doesn't agree and says, I have the right to the trial, the state has the right to the trial without delay, that right would be trumped by the defendant's right to waive if the defendant can say, I'll be denied a fair trial unless I have additional time.
That may be so, because the rights granted by this particular provision, as always under the Supremacy Clause, are going to be subject to the rights granted to a defendant hit by the United States Constitution, and that's made clear in subsection 2 of this. And so the defendant's right to a fair trial under the Due Process Clause, if he is able to establish that, he is not able to go to trial immediately and would be prejudiced by being forced to go to trial. That right may trump the state's right to a trial without delay under this provision.
Other questions on 88? Yes, Senator Verdes.
Chairman, just the same question. Is there anything in this resolution that would require a constitutional amendment, or could it be accomplished by statute? If I could follow up on Senator Duncan's question before to elaborate if any of it's already in statute.
Senator Bryant, Senator Burdick, Tim Sylvester, Attorney General's Office. This is one of those that does require a constitutional amendment, because in Senate Bill 936, one of the provisions of Senate Bill 936 was to grant the state the right to demand a jury trial, notwithstanding the defendant's waiver. And the Supreme Court in State v. Baker a few months ago held that statute conflicts with a defendant's right to waive jury under Article 1, Section 11 of the Oregon Constitution. And so this particular provision in H.J.R. 88 needs to be by constitutional amendment, or it would be unacceptable.
Mr. Chairman, in the provision you're talking about is the provision that allows the state to demand a jury trial.
That's correct.
Okay.
Other questions on 88? Why don't we go then to HJR 89.
Senator Bryant, members of the committee, I'm sorry.
Chairman Bryant, members of the committee, I think there is one change in that the Attorney General did not direct his attention to, and that's on page 2, and we added the word or indictment in subsection 3, and that's because this, in fact, affects not only heavy juries or trial juries, but also grand juries. And we felt that it was important to add for indictment because those are the things that come out of grand juries that might be affected.
On page 2 of the proposed amendment from the Attorney General's office, Vern, you'll see that under subsection 3 of paragraph 1, taking out the word for indictment.
Take that out.
Are there questions on 89? HJR 90.
Chairman, members of the committee, as I discussed, we offered the same sets of amendments here as we did in 88, specifically to expand the prosecutorial authority language from district attorney to prosecuting attorney for the same reason that we got the name. That was it.
Does it concern you at all in subsection 2 of paragraph 1 and it's also in some of the other resolutions where this becomes effective on or after the date? Would it be better to give like 30 days after the election is certified? Just to allow some time in order to anticipate these changes in court proceedings?
Chairman Bryant, that is not a bad idea. Having been a trial judge, we're generally aware of what changes the law may make in terms of the electoral process. However, always having a little bit of time to prepare and be prepared for those changes is not necessarily a bad thing.
Well, and also the exact date, you have the election date and the counts, and there might be recounts, and then there's a certification by the Secretary of State. And I don't know if the judges and the attorneys know exactly when that date's going to be, and they might miss it by a day or two, either instituting this a little ahead of time or missing it by a day or two. So, Mr. Taylor, you might remember that comment. Thank you.
As it relates to all
those that have it being commenced on or after the date the section is approved.
3 days thereafter.
There you go. Questions on HJR 90? Yes, Roberta.
Same question. What elements of this, if any, specifically require a constitutional amendment, and which could be done statutorily?
Senator Bryant, Senator Burdick, this is one that would require a constitutional amendment because as the Constitution presently exists, other than for murder, aggravated murder and treason, a defendant would be entitled to release on sufficient sureties, and so if you're going to restrict that particular right, it will need to be done by constitutional amendment.
Okay, so the bail part of it, and then I think that's all on this. Okay, thank you.
91.
Senator Bryant, members of the committee, again, Tim Sylvester from the Appellate Division of the Department of Justice. I'm here to speak on HJR 91 and HJR 93, both of which present similar issues. Both of these, as they are currently drafted and as I think they are intended, purport to require in the course of a criminal prosecution that Article 1, Section 9, in this case, and 93, Article 1, Section 12 of the Constitution, of the Oregon Constitution, be construed the same as and to be not having further expansive reading than under the comparable provisions of the federal Constitution, which is the Fourth Amendment in this case and the Fifth Amendment in HJR 93. our concern with that particular, what we have called the lockstep, and it's often called the lockstep provision, that they shall be construed the same, is that there is some authority for the proposition that these locks, a lockstep provision like this constitutes what might be called a revision of the Constitution, insofar as it restricts the ability of the Oregon Supreme Court to adopt an independent interpretation of an Oregon constitutional provision. There was a similar case in the state of California in which the California Supreme Court struck down a similar provision as a revision of the Constitution. In this state, for a the Oregon Constitution to be revised, it needs to be by way of a constitutional amendment that is originates in the legislature and is submitted to the people, and it requires a two-third vote of both houses in order to be submitted to the voters. And so in order for this particular provision to be valid as a revision of the Oregon Constitution, it would need two-thirds vote of both the House and the Senate. We do not have definitive authority under our revision clause, which is Article 17 of the Oregon Constitution, what precisely a revision would be and whether this sort of amendment would constitute a revision. That was an issue that was before the Supreme Court in the Armada litigation, and the court did not get to that issue. And so I'm not here to say that this undoubtedly will be a revision or the Supreme Court would construe this to be a revision, but there is a substantial possibility that if it goes out in its present form, this may be invalidated by the Supreme Court in the future as an unconstitutional revision. I'm not saying that the court will do that, but there's a possibility that the court will do that. And so with that risk presented, what we are suggesting here is a minor modification of the proposal in order to eliminate the revision clause argument and to allow this to take effect in a way that will, I think, survive all constitutional challenges. As I understand the intent behind this particular proposal, the idea is that evidence that is obtained in violation of Article 1, Section 9, but otherwise was obtained in compliance with the Fourth Amendment, should be admitted against the defendant in a criminal prosecution or a juvenile delinquency proceeding. And so what we have proposed here is an elimination of the lockstep provision in language that simply and squarely says that evidence relevant to the guilt of a criminal defendant or to the sentence shall not be excluded for the reason it is obtained in violation of Section 9 of this article, which is the search and seizure provision. Subsection 2 of this provision goes on to provide, as it must under the Supremacy Clause, that this does not restrict a criminal defendant's rights under the United States Constitution. And so if a police officer obtains evidence that in full compliance with the Fourth Amendment, but that violates, in a manner that violated Article 1, Section 9 of the Oregon Constitution, that evidence nonetheless would be admissible in a criminal prosecution, and the defendant or anybody who is affected by that particular violation would be relegated to other remedies, such as civil remedies or disciplinary action against the police officer. And so that is the purpose of our proposed amendment to H.J.R. 91.
Could you provide me with a written summary of the arguments you just espoused? I imagine they're included in your briefing on Armada. I understand it as you explained it to me today, but in a week that might be foggy in my mind and I might have to give this explanation to someone else. So if you could provide me with that reasoning and the possibilities, that would be helpful.
Senator Bryant, Chairman Bryant, do you mean an example of a situation in which this would apply?
Yes, and the fact that the court hasn't ruled on whether or not this particular process would meet constitutional scrutiny, the need of a two-thirds vote in the House and the Senate, those issues, if you could put those in writing to me, that would be helpful.
I can do that.
Yes. If I could ask the indulgence of you and the committee. What do you mean by lockstep on requiring a revision?
Chairman Bryan, Senator Burdick, that is just kind of a colloquialism. What it means is that it would be a provision that requires a provision that the courts interpret a provision of the Oregon Constitution to have no broader effect than a comparable provision of the United States Constitution. So, for example, the United States Supreme Court may construe the Fourth Amendment, the search and seizure provisions of the Fourth Amendment, to have a certain coverage, for example, in the context of a search warrant. And a lockstep provision would preclude the Oregon Supreme Court from construing the comparable provision of the Oregon Constitution to provide a defendant with any greater rights in that circumstance.
Mr. Chairman, wouldn't the proper way to do that would be simply to repeal Section 9? Wouldn't that be the way to reverse the federal Constitution?
Chairman Bryan, Senator Burdick, that would be one way to do it. That would be, I suppose, taking a meat cleaver approach to solving the particular problem, because it's important to note that under both HJR 91 and 93, these provisions apply only in the context of a criminal prosecution. And so to eliminate Article 1, Section 9 entirely, Article 1, Section 9 has application to a whole variety of different situations, civil. It's a limitation generally on the police power of officers in the state of Oregon. And so what this provision is intended to do merely is to cut back on the remedy for a violation. Under the current interpretation of Article 1, Section 9, a violation of evidence obtained in violation of Article 1, Section 9 has to be suppressed in criminal prosecution. And what this will do is say, no, you cannot suppress it for that violation, unless, of course, it also was obtained in violation of the Fourth Amendment.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, one final question.
Senator Burdick.
I don't see how your change eliminates the lockstep problem as you've described it, because basically what you're saying here, evidence relevant to the, on page one, there's the three-line change, the four-line change. But you're still saying that basically that you're reverting back to the federal Constitution.
Chairman Bryan, Senator Burdick, it does not. Although it refers back to the federal Constitution, it does not require the Oregon Supreme Court to interpret Article 1, Section 9 to be no broader than the Fourth Amendment. The court still would have the authority to rule that what the officer did, even though it was in compliance with the Fourth Amendment, the officer violated Article 1, Section 9, and so they are not in a lockstep. The court merely would be precluded from granting suppression as a remedy for that violation. That is not a lockstep. That is merely a limitation on the remedy to be granted for a constitutional violation.
Thank you.
What other remedy could there be other than suppression?
Chairman Bryant, there's a variety of different remedies that could be available. I do want to point out that subsection 2 of the provision says nothing in the section creates any cause of action for compensation or damages. But there could be, for example, an action for injunction. There could be to prevent the police officer from doing that again. There could be a motion for return of things seized, depending on what they are. There could be a disciplinary action against the police officer or any other appropriate civil action.
Senator,
in the Armada decision, was there a distinction drawn between the U.S. Constitution and Oregon's Constitution in regards to the Fourth Amendment search and seizure issues? Do they address those two distinctive differences?
Chairman Bryant, Senator Tarno, they did not address that issue in the Armada decision. They based their decision on simply a provision of the Oregon Constitution.
Mr. Chair, do we have, within your office, I'm not asking you to go back and write it up, but do we already have in writing someplace within the AG's office a distinctive difference between the U.S. And Oregon's opinion on Fourth Amendment rights and those issues? Do you know if they exist?
There is no accumulation of
cases in which things are, where the result is different under the Fourth Amendment than under Article 1, Section 9, that kind of changes from day to day, depending on how our courts construe Article 1, Section 9. There are a few specific areas where I know established case law is that Article 1, Section 9 is construed to grant the defendant broader rights than the Fourth Amendment. For example, in inventory searches, if a police officer arrests somebody and takes the car. Mm-hmm. Another good example is if a police officer obtains consent for a search from somebody, and the officer in reasonable reliance on that consent does a search, under the Fourth Amendment, that will be okay even if the person actually didn't have authority to consent to the search. Under Article 1, Section 9, if the person didn't have actual authority to consent to the search, then the evidence has to be suppressed, notwithstanding that the officer reasonably relied on that consent.
Okay.
Senator Brown.
Excuse me, this is my second question of the afternoon. As I read the Fourth Amendment and then Section 9, like, the words are practically the same. So, in fact, they're basically the same except for the first four or five words, which is one of them. Anyway. So I guess my question is, what are folks trying to accomplish? And the reason I ask that is, couldn't our courts interpret, I assume then the Fourth Amendment becomes the floor?
That's correct.
Our courts interpret the Fourth Amendment the same way they've been interpreting Section 9, Article 1, Section 9?
Chairman Bryant, Senator Brown, our courts in the interpretation of the Fourth Amendment are bound by controlling decisions of the United States Supreme Court. Our courts have independent authority to interpret Article 1, Section 9. In a wide variety of areas, the language is that way, is almost identical, and historically, the purposes behind the provisions are identical. Nonetheless, our Supreme Court has, in some instances, interpreted Article 1, Section 9 to be more expansive as to the privacy rights of the defendant than the U.S. Supreme Court has interpreted the Fourth Amendment. And that's
correct. So we're binding ourselves to several case law.
We would not be confining ourselves to federal case law under this provision as we have drafted it. Our courts still would have independent authority to construe Article 1, Section 9 as they saw fit, but in the situation where evidence is obtained in violation of Article 1, Section 9, the evidence will not be subject to suppression in a criminal prosecution if that evidence otherwise was obtained in compliance with the Fourth Amendment. If you follow.
If what you're saying is if they follow Section 9, then we're bound by state case law, and if they follow the Fourth Amendment, we're bound by federal case law. Is that what the distinction is?
Senator Burdick, our courts in interpreting the Fourth Amendment always are bound by the federal United States Supreme Court decisions interpreting that clause.
Right.
Because that's the federal document. As far as the state document, our courts are not bound by any federal court decision in interpreting Article 1, Section 9 because it is our organic document. And so our courts are free to interpret it however they want. Typically, our courts will follow the same approach that the U.S. Supreme Court has taken under the Fourth Amendment when we are dealing with virtually identical constitutional provisions. But they can take that. They are not obliged to take that, and there are some circumstances in which our court has interpreted Article 1, Section 9 to be more broad than the federal Constitution. And so what you sometimes end up with is a gray area where what the officer did was lawful under the Fourth Amendment, but was unlawful under Article 1, Section 9, as our court has interpreted. And what this provision deals with is what happens when you fall in that gray area. And what this says is evidence that was obtained by the officer in that gray area, it might be an Article 1, Section 9 violation, but the appropriate remedy is not exclusion of the evidence. The appropriate remedy is some other remedy, and the evidence comes in a criminal prosecution.
Chair Bryant, Senator Burdick, and Senator Brown, if I could kind of respond. I think that Senator Brown hit upon the fact that these two provisions, the Fourth Amendment and Article 1, Section 9, are very, very similar, and yet there have been different interpretations, and that is probably the reason that you have the HDR in front of you today. And to answer your question, Senator Burdick, I think to encapsulate it, the Oregon Supreme Court could interpret Article 1, Section 9 differently than the Fourth Amendment, but they just couldn't do much about it because their remedy of suppression would be gone.
It becomes a civil issue than a criminal one. Other questions on anyone? On HDR 92, you have no written suggestions. And why is that?
Chair Bryant, we didn't see anything that from the scope of the review and analysis that the Attorney General laid out to the committee that we needed to comment to the committee as far as making changes.
Committee, you're being passed out the recommendations that were discussed in the House that were provided by the Attorney General's office. Let's turn then to Section 8 and yes.
Can I just ask really quickly? I assume that requiring going from a 12-person to an 11-person jury to a per murder conviction would require a constitutional amendment, or could that be accomplished by statute?
Chair Bryant, Senator Burdick, I believe that is a requirement of a constitutional change because verdicts of murder, not distinguishing between aggravated or simple murder, are required in the Constitution to be unanimous.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Senator Duncan.
I'm just curious, Mark, as a judge, so did you change that guy? You watched lots of juries. I haven't. I watch TV a lot.
Chair Bryant, Senator Duncan, I think that's a policy decision that the legislature is going to have to make. I think that there are occasions where one person, you know, just basically for whatever reason, kind of goes off the reservation and doesn't do what is clearly, based upon the evidence, the appropriate thing to do. I do point out that in many other cases that have very, very significant sentences, and we're talking now about rape one, sodomy one, arson one, manslaughter, things like that, we allow 10-2 verdicts, and yet we require the sentences that can be imposed to be very long. What you're weighing against here, and the policy choice that you have to make, is whether or not, you know, you want the certainty, I guess, basically, for the longer period of time between the ranges of sentences that are presented for those kinds of cases, and murder, which can be up to 30 years, or life, as opposed to basically getting to justice, where one person, you know, just doesn't want to do what is the appropriate thing, perhaps, to do based upon the evidence, and the person, therefore, isn't found guilty of the offense and doesn't suffer the consequences that perhaps they should. I don't think I answered the question, though, about what I'd personally do.
And you can't make it either. Let's go on to 93 then.
Chairman Bryant, members of the committee, I'm speaking on HDR 93. This has similar problems to the HDR 91, the possibility that this would be an unconstitutional revision. This one, and so we decided to suggest a revision of this in order to eliminate that particular possibility. This also presents an armada problem, a multiple amendments problem, and I need to spend a couple of minutes talking about that. This provision also is a lockstep, or as drafted and I think intended and probably reasonably construed, is to be a lockstep to require Article 1, Section 12 of our Constitution to be construed no more broadly than the Fifth Amendment in the course of criminal prosecution. Article 1, Section 9 dealt simply with search and seizure, and so there was not an armada problem there. This particular provision presents an armada problem because Article 1, Section 12 has two discrete issues addressed in that particular section. One is the double jeopardy clause, and the other is the compelled self-incrimination clause. And so to lockstep Article 1, Section 12 to the Fifth Amendment, which also has those two clauses, would appear to require, appear to be an amendment both to the double jeopardy clause and to the self-incrimination clause. And in State versus, or Armada versus State of Oregon, the Oregon Supreme Court said that if you amend two separate constitutional provisions, they have to be submitted to the voters separately. Arguably, although this is amending only a single section of Article 1, Section 12, of Article 1, nonetheless, it may be construed as amending two separate constitutional provisions, one the double jeopardy clause and one the self-incrimination clause. And so that is one issue that we wanted to address by our amendment. As I understand from the proponents, the primary or perhaps sole purpose of this particular HJR is to limit the scope of immunity from prosecution under the self-incrimination clause. And so that is what we have proposed here is an amendment. But effectively will be an amendment to Article 1, Section 12 that will limit the scope of immunity that is to be required by the compelled self-incrimination clause of the Oregon Constitution. Under the federal Constitution, in order for a person to be compelled to provide testimony against himself, he or she has to be provided immunity from prosecution. And that particular immunity, in order to comply with the Fifth Amendment, is what is called use and derivative use immunity. That is, we cannot, if you are compelled to testify, we cannot use that testimony against you, nor may we use any evidence that the state subsequently derives from that testimony. And that is the whole scope of the immunity that's required by the Fifth Amendment. Under Article 1, Section 12, our Oregon Supreme Court has construed, again, virtually identical language to provide or to require a broader scope of immunity in order to compel somebody to testify. And that type of immunity is called transactional immunity. Under transactional immunity, in order to require somebody to testify, you have to essentially prevent any prosecution in the future of that person for any crime that may relate to the subject of the testimony.
Except the Monica Lewinsky type of
thing. That's correct. And so what we have done here is we have drafted this in order essentially to enact under Article 1, Section 12. This is not a direct amendment to Article 1, Section 12, but essentially to say in the course and prosecution of a criminal offense, a person will have only use and derivative use immunity, which is the immunity granted by the Fifth Amendment, and not the broader transactional immunity previously guaranteed under Article 1, Section 12. And anticipating a question from Senator Burdick, this is one that would require a constitutional amendment.
In the way you drafted it, it would alleviate the Armada single issue problem, correct?
Correct. It addresses only immunity.
This isn't, I guess, for Matt particularly, this witness, but for anyone else in the panel, in terms of, as I read these resolutions that we've gone through, we've really added juvenile court proceedings at the same level as adult court proceedings. Doesn't that give juveniles the same rights then that adults have as a result of these?
Well, Chairman Bryan, Senator Brown, in the course of a prosecution in juvenile court on delinquency, a prosecution of a juvenile for delinquency petition, although that is not, quote unquote, a criminal prosecution, in almost every respect, a juvenile in that proceeding has the same rights as a defendant in a criminal prosecution. About the only significant right is the right that a juvenile is not afforded is the right to a jury trial.
Don't you think the cumulative effects of these amendments may provide the juvenile delinquent with a right to a jury trial?
That remains to be seen.
How would you know that? You could provide, I guess, to make sure that this will not entitle a juvenile to the right of it. To a jury trial. And then the sponsor will testify later, and you might ask them how they feel about that. Other questions on 93? Let's turn to 94.
Chair Bryant, members of the committee, Pamela Wood from the Department of Justice. I would direct the committee's attention to what I believe is the operative language in A. and Both House Joint Resolution 94, which is found in subsection 1A, in particular the language that we have a concern about today. Essentially, what this language does is impose a general prohibition on laws that would permit a term of imprisonment to be set aside or otherwise not carried out, and then provides two express exceptions to that prohibition. One of them relates to the power of the governor, and that is not at issue here, I don't believe. The other relates to what is called judicial authority to grant appellate or post-conviction relief. Now, obviously, judicial authority to grant appellate or post-conviction relief is authority of an appellate court or what we might call a post-conviction court, which I believe would include a habeas corpus court. What I believe is the effect of this language under the principles of statutory construction that we apply in this state, constitutional and statutory construction in this state, is that by expressly referring to the authority of appellate and post-conviction courts and not referring and omitting any reference to any other types of courts, it would have the effect of precluding modification of any kind of a sentence by a sentencing court. And I believe that I can give you several examples of current authority that sentencing courts have that would be called into question by this provision as it's currently drafted. One of them would just be the simple authority of a sentencing court under one of our statutes in Chapter 138 to address a clerical error in a sentencing order or a judgment, or to modify or delete an erroneous term in a sentencing order or judgment. Another would be the kind of authority that this legislature has conferred on sentencing courts, such as that embodied in 1997 Senate Bill 1049, where upon determining it may be appropriate in some cases to impose non-Measure 11 sentences for certain Measure 11 crimes. This was the bill relating to robbery 2, assault 2, and kidnapping 2. It also authorized sentencing courts to go back and revisit, and in fact it uses the word resentence, persons who had been convicted and sentenced after the effective date of Measure 11, but prior to that modification, statutory modification in 1997 under Senate Bill 1049. An additional and I think a particularly interesting example is the statute that was adopted by the 1997 legislature as part of Senate Bill 936, which allows sentencing courts to authorize executing and releasing authorities to implement the sorts of modifications of sentences, and these are somewhat different modifications because they are implemented by administrative agencies, but it does authorize sentencing courts to allow defendants to be considered by those administrative agencies for the kinds of sentence reductions that we commonly also consider to be sentence modifications. Again, because it does impose a general prohibition and expressly refers to particular kinds of judicial modification, if I may so call it, of sentences, I think it would preclude those kinds that are exemplified by the statutes that I've just described. As a result of that, what we've simply chosen to suggest is that the language that you see in paragraph A be added. This would permit laws that authorize sentencing courts to make the kinds of modifications of sentences that I've discussed.
Without doing that, the legislature in the future, if it's passed, couldn't do future amendments like we did in 97 that you just described, correct?
Chair Bryant, I believe that not only would it call into question the ability of the legislature to do that in the future, but it may call into question the validity of the existing statutes that perform those functions, whether clerical, whether the kinds of reconsiderations of the length of a sentence that are the subject of Senate Bill 1049, or whether they relate to the kinds of in-custody modifications that we think of when we think of the ability of the Department of Corrections, say, to grant earned time once it has been authorized by the court, as Senate Bill 936 sets out. I should say, and I'm sure everyone here is aware of that, of course, Senate Bill 936 was intended to implement Ballot Measure 40, a very closely related or basically the equivalent provision of this. But Ballot Measure 40, subsection 1J, which was the equivalent of this, did not have the express exceptions relating to the governor and the appellate and post-conviction courts, and therefore didn't raise the issue of construction that is raised here by these express exceptions and the lack of any reference to the authority of sentencing courts.
If I read this, I can't... As authorized by the sentencing court, to me this says that the sentencing court can go back and, you know, maybe give credit for good time or whatever is already allowed by statute. But the way I read this, we still would not be able to do another Senate Bill 1049 or something like it. Am I wrong? Would that be allowed? Would we be able to direct? Because it says no law shall permit a term of imprisonment imposed by a judge in open court to be set aside or otherwise not carried out.
Chair Bryant, Senator Burdick, I believe that this would permit that because the purpose of this is to have these modifications, and I'm using that to cover that entire continuum from clerical through the court, resentencing on length or whatever, and through administrative agencies, statutorily authorized reduction programs, excuse me. But I do believe that it would allow that because this would encompass that mechanism by which that modification occurs through the approval, so to speak, the authority and the approval and the consideration by the sentencing court. That is the intent, I believe, of the proponents, that this be accomplished in that method and not through sort of invisible mechanisms that occur automatically without the authority of the court and so forth.
Chair Bryant, Senator Burdick, I agree with Pam Wood. What it does is it creates a window that the legislature can act through, in essence, because the Constitution says that the sentencing court can do something, and the legislature basically has the ability to tell the sentencing court how it may act in certain circumstances. And so if the legislature, for example, said there would be good time in a particular circumstance and the sentencing court was authorized in appropriate circumstances to apply that, this constitutional provision would allow that to occur.
Mr. Chairman, and if I could ask the same question, I presume what you're saying here also is that this particular change would require a constitutional amendment. It could not be done through statute.
Chair Bryant, Senator Burdick, I believe that this could be accomplished by statute.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions concerning HGR 94? Other questions for this panel? Thank you. This time we'll call Floyd to Nancy. Oh, yes, she does. So we'll call her off right now, too. Then we'll go to Dale Penn and Norm Frank, and then followed by Kathy Algren and Ingrid Clinton.
We have to speak. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on the HJRs that are before you, 87 through 94. What we are passing out to you are some different handouts that have been used on the floor during the presentation to the committee, excuse me, to the members of the House. What I'd like to do is take a few moments to go through the individual HJRs, as well as reviewing some principles I believe that you as a body of the Senate have a duty to do as an elected official.
We do have copies in our booklet of the minority report.
Okay, and I appreciate that. What we have handed out for your consideration when you're reviewing and making determinations is a comparison of the majority versus the minority report. So I did understand that you were going to have those in your packet. We also have a handout from the Association of Oregon Counties that refers to HJR 90. Also a list as to why I believe it's important to not have HJR 91 go forward based on public policy reasons. And then I also have included a copy of two news clips that were in our Capitol report that I have expressed my positions regarding these measures for your consideration at a time in the future. What I want to, I guess, start off with, Mr. Chair, if I could, is the principles of making referrals to the people. I believe this committee, as well as each and every one of us that are elected officials, has a duty, a legislative duty, to independently review all the proposals that would be referred to the voters, and not to just rubber stamp something because, as we heard during committee and we heard on the floor of the House, that this is something that was before the voters, and that because of that, you should just send it out without having any type of integrity as to whether or not it is good public policy and whether or not the form that it is being proposed through the what is now the HGRs 87 through 94 are appropriate. I know the proponents have asked and will continue to ask that Mr. Senator just refer what it is and let the voters decide. One thing that I find very puzzling is that it seems to me, from my perspective, from what I've reviewed, that the proponents of these measures do not want voters to have what I would consider accurate and concise information to ensure that they are fully informed as to the passage or whether they should, in fact, pass any or all of these measures. Specifically, what I'd like to ask you to consider is what we and this body have as an obligation under the statutory law. Before we make any changes to amend any law, it is a duty that we have in front of us a copy of what is the existing law and do a comparison. What is being proposed to you through the HJRs 88 through 93 is to make create new provisions under Article 1 where there are existing provisions under the Oregon Constitution. HJR 87 and 94 are new and will be new provisions within the Constitution, so there's nothing being amended. It is actually creating new provisions in the Constitution. I believe it's important for the voters to have the same rights and duty that we have when we review any legislation that is going to be passed on that is already on the books, and that is to make certain that they have the opportunity to review it in the context
of how she included it and how it will, in fact, modify the existing provisions of the Constitution. I do not believe it's appropriate for us to create new provisions that have superseding existing sections, because what you're going to do is you're going to be putting in front of the voters only part of the picture. You're not allowing them the opportunity to look at what is actually on the books now in our Constitution. And you also set up a position that in the future that people who are reviewing the Constitution will find conflicting provisions within the existing, from the existing statute or provisions of the Constitution to the new one. And I believe that that is not appropriate for us to be doing. The other thing I think is important in the principles of making referrals is make sure that we are having what I would call truth in labeling, and that we be very cautious about what we present to the voters, because as an elected body in a Republican form of government, I believe that the voters will put more credence into what we refer to them as compared to it coming through the initiative process. So I believe that we have a duty to make certain that what we put out to them is, in fact, what we say it is. Specifically on that is the victim's rights preamble language. And I will note that when you look at Measure 40 in the preamble, it does in fact have the information there. When you look at the companion statutory modifications that were made in 1997, Senate Bill 936, it is not there. What we did, we went into the statute, we made the changes, we did not include at that point the preamble language. So the question I would have for each and every one of you when you look at this is, why do we need to put the preamble language on each and every one of these provisions, and just in general, and also whether or not the preamble language is appropriate for each and every one of those? I would tell you today that there's only one of the HJRs that it is appropriate in, and that is 87. HJR 87 is, in fact, what I consider true enumerated rights for victims. Now, I believe the committee did, in fact, receive in the packet a chart comparing the proposed victim rights amendments for this state as compared to other states that currently have in their constitution signed victims' rights. This is a sheet that's 8.5 by 14, and if you have not had an opportunity to look at it, I encourage you to do so. Because when you do, and you'll see that when you compare the other states in this country that have these rights within their constitution, they basically have adopted some shape or form of HJR 87. There are five of the HJRs: 88, 89, 92, 93, and 94 that are nowhere in any other state, and there's, I believe, 31 other states that are listed here, could be 32, that have adopted in their constitution as a crime victim's right any of these provisions. Now, I'm not going to tell you that that doesn't mean that some of those do not exist, because they do. My understanding in the state of California, there is a state's right to a jury trial. But the bottom line is, they have identified it as for what it is. That is a state governmental right. It is not a victim's right. And so I'm asking you to be forthright with the voters to make certain that they know who actually has that right. Now, 87, I support, and I supported it on the floor. I will tell you that after one of the articles came out, which was the article from the Argonian, I received a phone call from a gentleman, a sergeant at the Portland Police Bureau. His name is Sergeant Michael Barkley. Sergeant Barkley wanted to express his concerns regarding one of the provisions that are in HJR 87. Unfortunately, he is not able to appear before you today because he said with the Rose Festival events going on, he was not able to take time out to be here. But he did ask me to express his concerns, and I told him I would. His concern is in his case, particular case, where he was, in fact, not found guilty, but he was facing criminal charges of various felony counts, that there were three victims that were identified for the purposes of that prosecution. It was determined by the court, I believe the judge was Judge Janice Wilson, that during the presentation of the case, that the victims who were allowed in the courtroom under the victims' rights process were somehow communicating with each other as they were giving testimony. The judge noted that, and after she was convinced that it was occurred, did in fact require the person to leave the courtroom because of, she felt that the defendant in that case rights were being violated, and that it was not appropriate for a victim to be signaling somehow another witness at the time that they were giving testimony. What I will show you on HJR 87 on the chart, there are two sub-key components, number one and number two, and those are things that you may want to consider in if you want to make any modifications to HJR 87, which would allow for two things. Number one, that the victim's rights shall not interfere with the rights of the accused. I've heard from the testimony upstairs some committee members being concerned to make certain that we would not run afoul to any federal safeguards as to making certain that an individual who is accused, not convicted, but only accused, receives a fair trial, and that their rights are not somehow secondary to the rights of victims. The other component is that the judges have discretion to prohibit victims from being present in the courtroom if the victim will be testifying. And I'm not sure how the states that are listed here actually conduct that challenge, or if it's absolute or not. I believe it probably varies from state to state. But those are things that Sergeant Barkley asked me to bring to your attention, and I told him that I would. Regarding the next one, which is House Bill, HJR 88, I guess I want to go over a couple of things that I think is important. Again, most of the stuff that I will be addressing are basically making sure that whatever we send to the voters is not misidentified for what it is, and that makes certain that we are not somehow creating a new provision where we have an existing provision. HJR 88 is one of those that does already have an existing provision in the Constitution. It is within Section 11, Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution, and I would encourage this body that if you are, in fact, going to send this out to the voters, that you use some language similar to the Minority Report in HJR 88, because it there clearly states and puts in context for everyone to vote on and to see what they're voting on, what the existing statute, or excuse me, provisions of the Constitution says, including the rights of the accused in the criminal prosecution, as well as just inserting the simple three words and the state to allow for a jury trial or for them to not allow for a trial by the court. The other parts within HJR 88, I believe, are pretty self-explanatory, and I believe that that's something that as a policy decision, if we are going to put it out for the voters, let's make certain that they understand what they're voting on and put it in the context of the existing provisions. HJR 89 is one that I would tell you that I personally do not support because I believe it's bad public policy. As you heard yesterday from the testimony, and I'm not sure what you heard earlier this afternoon, this is the component that deals with jury pools. We currently are one of 27 states or the District of Columbia that uses a two-list system to determine who will be sitting or possibly sitting on a jury. The majority report that's before you now as the committee report would prohibit individuals who are not registered to vote from being able to sit on a jury. And I've heard many different reasons why that is appropriate, but I have not been satisfied that there's any rational or logical reason to believe that an individual who has somehow registered to vote is going to be more appropriate to determine someone's guilt in a criminal proceeding. The other part I think is also important is no matter what we send to voters, it should in fact be in the existing context. The provision is Section 5, Article 7 of the amended Oregon Constitution, where it deals with jury pools. And when you look at the language that is set forth in there, it basically makes the changes that are necessary both for grand juries as well as for the criminal case. And I guess what I want to also let you know is that we received information, I believe this was from the Portland State University. They had done a sampling of Oregon voters to determine the percentage of people who were registered to vote or not registered to vote, and they did it on a on poll share as a resident. It's based on the sampling they did, which was for 1994, November of 1994 data. It appeared that 75.5 1.5% of the whites who were eligible to be registered were in fact registered. In black, it was 50%, and for Hispanic origin, it was down to 24.6%. So clearly what you see from that sampling for the state of Oregon, that there is a disparity of the number of people based on race, them being registered to vote, and I do not believe that it provides for a fair cross-section. I know that there is a case that was recently handled through the Court of Appeals that stated the defendant who attempted to raise that as an argument had no merit and that they did not have a right to have a broader cross-section. But I would challenge you to consider, and I believe the testimony yesterday went over this some, as to whether or not an individual who wants to serve on a jury, who chooses not to be registered to vote, whether or not they would have a successful challenge under a claim that their right to serve is being prohibited by their failure to register to vote. Mr. Chair, I think maybe I should stop and make certain there's no questions before I move to the next one. I apologize I didn't ask that after H.J.R. 87.
Well, this group isn't shy about asking questions. Senator Verdi.
Mr. Chair, thank you. The Attorney General's office, the people who came to testify, said that in their opinion, H.J.R.s 87, 89, and 94 could be accomplished by statute. Those subject matters could be accomplished by statute. What is your view on that, and what is your political assessment of how, if it could be accomplished by statute, the pluses and minuses of doing it by statute?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I guess I would have to agree with them as to that they could be done by statute. I would say that for me, the policy decision that we have to make is what do we want to put in the Constitution, how much do we want to put in the Constitution. As we all know that once something is in the Constitution, we have basically limited our ability to make any changes that may need to be made in the future for whatever reason they may occur. We have seen that with other measures that have come through the initial process, such as Measure 17, which was the inmate work program. There are problems here that had to be changed, and we had to go back to the voters to make those changes because we as a body were not able to make those changes since it was within the Constitution. It's interesting when you look at H.R. 87, you look across one of the states, Montana, basically in their Constitution has limited what they have put in for victims' rights is basically a statement regarding basic principles of criminal justice. And it's my belief that what they have done and the reason they did that is that they wanted to make certain that they could have the ability within the legislative process to make changes that they felt were necessary and put it within the statutory scheme. And I would have to say as an elected official, I believe that is one of the duties that we have as in a Republican form of government is to make certain that we are able to do what we are elected to do, and that is to make policy for this state. Clearly, we should be using the Constitution to give us the framework, the basic principles of what we believe are appropriate for the concepts that we want to have within our statutory scheme. But I would encourage this committee, wherever possible, to not limit our ability to make changes by placing something in the Constitution that can, in fact, be placed in within the statute. And the other part I would say is that when you look at what we originally had in 1987, there were crime victims' rights that were adopted through the statutory process, and many of the components of 87 were, in fact, kept in were actually in the statutes and were not in the Constitution. It's when we had the change with Measure 40 passing, there was quick haste to make modifications to what was existing in the Constitution and statutory scheme and to adopt SB 936, which became the statutory equivalent to Measure 40. One thing I did not mention to you in H.J.R. 87, which I do believe is important for you to remember and consider, and you may be hearing this later if you did not hear it yesterday, there are some concerns as to the current version that's before you as to whether or not it will have some impact on the juvenile court proceedings or process. The way that the proponents identified how they wanted to go forward on this was if they identified juvenile offenders or an individual who had been adjudicated an alleged youth offender as criminal defendants. The concern that I received from the Juvenile Rights Project, Inc., was that they believe that by doing so, we could inadvertently have some type of impact on the juvenile justice system, either by placing this into the Constitution of identifying juveniles as criminal defendants. We could, in fact, be either abolishing what we have as statutory courts, which are the juvenile courts, or we could be giving them rights they currently do not have in through the juvenile process, such as the right to bail, such as the right to jury trial.
Let me interrupt you there. I guess I see us as very few distinctions at this point between juvenile and adult courts. Why not give juveniles the right to jury trial?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I'm not saying that we shouldn't do that. I'm looking at the broader picture of the policy. We currently have a statutory scheme for our juvenile courts. They are not identified or acknowledged, from my understanding, anywhere in our state constitution. And if we start to mix apples and oranges, that may be the result. Now, that's a policy decision that I believe as a body we should consider in the appropriate sense, and it could be done by statute. If we believe that we think that juvenile proceedings should now have the full protections and rights of a criminal defendant, then that's something we could do, I believe, through the existing statute statutory scheme. All I have on 87, and unless there's other questions about 88, Mr. Chair, I'll move on to 89. Now, 89, I believe, is one of these issues. All of these are policy issues. It's a pretrial release. I do believe that there is an appropriateness to make certain that the community, as well as the individual victim of the matter, are safe during the proceeding or the time that a court would have a matter before it. I will tell you that based on the handout that has been given to you regarding the Association of Oregon Industries position, it seems appropriate to me that we need to make certain the wording that is being used in that context is going to give the protection that I believe we all want to make certain is there, but it is not such a broad net that we actually require people to be released that have in fact been convicted of crimes that are serving time within the county's facilities, because there's a mandate and a requirement that someone that has been accused of a crime be held pretrial. When you look at the letter that's dated May 19th from the Association of Oregon Counties, it talks about modifying some of the language that is in the existing measure that's before you as the HJR 90. And I would tell you that if you use or utilize the minority report language, you would identify and deal with the issue that they raised. And that is why we put forward that minority report to make certain that we were not going to over broadly impact the correction facilities in the counties to not be able to maintain custody of people who have in fact been convicted of a crime. The other parts that I think again are important is that the proposal now would start a new provision within Article 1 instead of amending the existing Section 14 of Article 1. And I believe that is, again, appropriate for us to put before the voters what is currently in the Constitution for them to decide if we are going to move forward with this as a policy decision to send to the voters. I also would say that the preamble language in this matter, as well as all the others except for 87, are not appropriate because they are not dealing with victims' rights per se. They are dealing with rights of the state or the government. Now, moving, if there's no questions on 90, I'll move on to 91. Regarding HJR 91, this is an issue that I oppose, and we did not run the minority report on HJR 91 because I believe it would set a very dangerous precedent for our state. 91 as well as 93 would be what is known as lockstepping the Oregon Constitution to the interpretation of the federal constitution. I do not believe that the founders of this state are intended for us in the future to somehow take away protections, safeguards, and rights that are under the Oregon Constitution, and to make them subordinate to the interpretation of the federal judiciary, who has no accountability to the voters of this state. It's very puzzling to me that we are willing to do this, and I would question the wisdom of doing that. When you look at the majority report, it actually does something that I don't think anyone would want to intend to do. It basically abolishes Article 1, Section 9 under the Oregon Constitution as the committee report came out. What the minority report that we did not run actually did include was a safeguard. So if for some reason we were going to send this out, and if for some reason in the future the U.S. Supreme Court determined that the Fourth Amendment does not apply to the states, that it would in fact basically resurrect Article 1, Section 9. Let me explain what I mean by that. The U.S. Constitution Article Fourth Amendment did not apply to the states until the early 1960s. U.S. Map versus Ohio, I guess it was the case that actually brought to the states the protections of the Fourth Amendment. So if the U.S. Supreme Court did not make that determination until 1960, clearly if the court should change, they could make an interpretation that would say it no longer applies to the state. And if we abolish the existing provisions of the Oregon Constitution, as the committee report provides, we would no longer have any safeguards or protections in the state regarding search and seizure. Now, I'm very concerned also as to the precedent that this will draw.
I was going to answer your question there, and that is, you're saying abolishing Article 9 with respect to the criminal code, correct? I mean, as I read the application of HGR 91, that would not apply in administrative proceeding cases, civil cases, etc., regarding criminal cases.
I believe that's correct.
Okay.
The other concerns that I have about 91, and there's a letter that I believe was made part of your packet from Representative Mike Lehman that went to the floor dated May 26th of this year. He talks about the concern of having both 91 and 93 lockstep into the interpretation of the U.S. Constitution. He used the analogy of what we currently have in our state constitution regarding the right to bear arms. If you look at the Oregon Constitution, Article 1, Section 27, it states on the right to bear arms, military subordinate to civil power. It says, "The people shall have the right to bear arms for the defense of themselves and the state, but the military shall be kept in strict subordination to the civil power." If you compare it to what is given as protection under the U.S. Constitution, under the Second Amendment, right to bear arms, it says, "A well-regulated militia being necessary to secure to the security of a free state, the right of the people to bear, keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." If you will notice, the part that is not in the Second Amendment that is, in fact, in the Oregon Constitution is the right to bear arms for the defense of themselves. Now, I ask you whether or not in this day and time, when we look at the gun legislation that's coming before us and the positions that some people are taking, whether or not it is conceivable, which I do believe it could be conceivable, that someone would want to make a change as to the limitation of the interpretation of the Oregon Constitution, Section 27, Article 1, to the interpretation of the U.S. Constitution of the Second Amendment. I believe that you want to be very careful and cautious before we start to limit our interpretations and our safeguards that are within the Oregon Constitution to subordinate it to the interpretation of the U.S. Constitution by a federal court. What I also have included within this packet is why I believe it is important to vote no, and how it's entitled on HJR 91. You've heard testimony as to some of the rights that Oregonians have under the safeguards and the protections of the Oregon Constitution. under the search and seizure provision, which is Article 1, Section 9, as compared to the federal system. If you look there under open field, under the Oregon Constitution, government agents cannot trespass on a person's private property or open field and must obey no trespassing signs. But there is no open field exception within the interpretation from the Washington, D.C. court. And under the Oregon Constitution, under the federal Constitution, government agents can, in fact, trespass on private open land with impunity. That is the case, and I won't go over the actual citation of the cases, but to me, it's disturbing that we would be willing to somehow limit the protections that we have in our Oregon Constitution to some lower standard than we have within the U.S. Constitution. There are other areas that I will just mention without going in great detail. Strip searches of children, school children, peering into someone's residence, search of vehicle for firearms, tracking devices, restroom surveillance, again, is also trespassing on private property. There are some areas here where the federal law is still unsettled, but I would caution each and every one of us before we want to lockstep our protections that are within the state constitution to what is provided at a threshold or base level, which is less than what we have in the U.S. Constitution. The other component here, again, is that I personally do not believe that we should be making a change, but if we are going to be making the change, then I think that we should, in fact, go into Article 1, Section 9 of the Oregon Constitution and make whatever proposed changes that would be there so the citizens could, in fact, look at that in its entirety. The next one is HJR 92. And what I would tell you here, this is one dealing where you would be able to have non-unanimous verdicts in the murder case. It also, again, creates a new section of Article 1 instead of amending the existing Section 11 of Article 1. My concern here is making sure that we give the voters the ability to see what is currently within the Constitution as compared to what is being proposed instead of having something supersede what is existing and being more confusing to the voters as well as the public once something should pass and be found in more than one article or provision within the Oregon Constitution. I also have a lot of concerns. As I told you, one of the handouts I had given you is regarding interviews that I gave regarding my positions on these measures. And in some detail, it goes over the experience I had when my sister was murdered when I was in high school. So I don't come in here, without having know what the grief that people go through, the anxiety that you have when you lose a not only a friend but a sister. But I do believe it's important that we make sure that the integrity of the process and what we have within our Constitution is protected. Regarding, and I do want to just revert back to 89, because 89 deals with search and seizure. I will tell you the person that murdered my sister did, in fact, get off on what would be considered a technicality. But I still believe that there are safeguards in place. The reality, the police in that situation did not do the job that they should have done. They relied on the assurances of his defense attorney, who used to be an assistant district attorney in Bexar County in San Antonio, as to certain things that didn't, that was supposed to happen that did not. It was basically a maneuver on the part of the defense to present basically fraud on the court. And the appellate court made the statement before they made the ruling that they hoped they never saw these facts again. So, and regarding HJR 92, 11-1 verdict, and a murder case, I guess there have been many stories that have come out. I believe you may have already received. If you haven't, I will make available to you, or there may be Representative Bowman may be going over this. I understand she will be here to testify as well, where individuals who have been convicted and placed on death row with a unanimous verdict, 12-0, only to find out later that they were not properly convicted because they were innocent. New evidence came in many cases of DNA, and so you have the bottom line on this is that you do, in fact, have mistakes that are being made, and I guess I would question whether or not it's a good policy for this state to allow the state, the government, to be able to prove their case on a lesser level of 11-1 instead of the unanimous verdict when an individual that is convicted of such a charge is going to be faced with a 25-year sentence minimum.
Yes, so you've been talking about search and seizure in your particular case, and I guess the question I would have for you, why would the ordinary citizen care whether the police are following the rules or not? Isn't the important thing here for the criminal to get convicted and off the street?
Chair Bryant, Senator Brown, we want to, and I believe as a prosecutor for the last 11 years, hold people accountable for their conduct. But I do believe that we are running the risk that when we change the rules and lower the threshold to be able to prove someone's guilt. Just remember, a person that is labeled a defendant is a person that has been accused of a crime. They have not been convicted. And I personally do not believe it's appropriate for us to lower those thresholds or to allow an individual in the sense of that law enforcement to work either in ignorance or believe in good faith they have the right to abridge someone's protections to bring in whatever evidence it may be. In my sister's case, there was a confession that was given. When they took the individual to the police department, they started to give him his Miranda rights. This was back in 1973, so I went from the perspective Miranda was in 64. And so many things were happening. Speedy Trial Act was not around at that time either. But the bottom line is when they walked in, after they notified the police of the location of the body, and then they brought him in, they had prepared a confession. They walked in, the officer, the detective said, I want to give him his Miranda rights, started to give him his Miranda rights, and the attorney told him that it's not necessary, that he'd already advised him his Miranda rights, and he was waiting any further reading. Then the detective said, well, you'll have no problem with me taking a confession or a statement from your client. And he said, no, I have no problem with you doing that, but you don't need to do that because we've already done that. And handed him a QA statement that basically admitted his guilt and setting up a defense of such a thing. The officer's mistake at that point was that he did not ask the individual whether or not that was his statement, whether or not it was voluntarily being given. And even though it was signed, he failed to ask the defendant or the accused at that point to re-sign that statement in front of him to acknowledge that it was, in fact, freely given, voluntarily given. And the bottom line is that the court, when the defense attorney that was representing him at that time, Mr. Hill, took the stand in the pretrial matters as well as during the pretrial matters that occurred at two different times, and basically said that he intentionally told the officers that these things were done when, in fact, that was not the case, that he had actually put his own statements in with the defendant's statements and basically went on from there. And I believe that's why the Court of Appeals came out with such strong language, that they felt that this was truly a fraud on the system and that they hoped that that would never occur again.
Well, if I could stop you at this convenient point, because of the number of witnesses, what I'm going to do is many of you I see on a regular basis, and what I'm going to do is reschedule public testimony on this on Monday to complete her public testimony. But there are some witnesses that have indicated they wouldn't be available to me through notes. And so, Floyd, you'd be available on Monday, wouldn't you?
Yes, sir. I'll be more than glad to come back.
Okay, let's do that. Mr. Groom indicates he can't be here, so I'd ask him to come up. Let me ask him some others. Professor Doug Balak. Okay, why don't you come forward then, too. Mona Simmons and Bradley Holiday. Could you come back on Monday? All right, then we'll have to take your testimony today, and Mr. Holiday. Okay, thank you. So if Dave Groom could come forward, and also Mona Simmons, pardon?
Dave Groom ultimately did have
to leave. Oh, okay. So Mona Simmons then, if she could come forward, and Professor Balak, and for the rest, and you're generally available too. Could you come on Monday also? So the people that have signed up will take their remainder of their testimony on Monday. Senator Tarnow and I have a meeting at 5:30. And, pardon? No, no, this is on condemnation.
Okay.
But we'll take these two witnesses' testimony and then adjourn for the day. So
thank you for your courtesy, Chair, and honorable members of the committee. I've had the pleasure of working with some of you in the past, whether you remember me or not. Kate Brown on domestic violence legislation, Mr. Courtney, in the days when we were trying to rein in sex offenses, and you played an important role in that. My name is Doug Ballouf. I teach law at Lewis and Clark Law School, the same law school that Steve Kanner teaches law at. I'm a nationally recognized expert in victims' laws around the country. I've testified in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee concerning the amendment to the United States Constitution granting victims' rights in the United States Constitution. I've written the only academic book in the subject, Victims in Criminal Procedure. And what I'm here to do is to testify about two things briefly, but I would note that I heard a lot of testimony and a lot of questions before you, and would be happy to serve as a general resource to you for any of the questions you feel that you might want an answer from me on. I'm testifying on the two most controversial bills, of course, House Resolution 91 and House Resolution 93. These are what other people have called the lockstep provisions. There has been some talk that these really have nothing to do with victims of crime, these provisions, and I would urge upon you that that is not so. It has everything to do with victims of crime. Basically, what happens when you exclude reliable evidence or relevant evidence is you make a value choice, and that value choice is we will exclude truthful, relevant evidence in favor of some other value. As a result, the exclusionary rule has been a rule that has been an extremely controversial rule. The way the United States Supreme Court has handled that rule is they have said, we will exclude truthful evidence or evidence that helps us lead to a truthful conclusion only when it is necessary to do so. When is it necessary to do so? According to the United States Supreme Court, this is when the exclusion of evidence serves to deter police misconduct. And so what the United States Supreme Court has done is it has taken a course which essentially says when we can deter illegal police conduct, we will do so by suppression. Where we cannot, we will let truthful evidence into court. And, of course, truthful evidence coming into court assists victims to a great deal. So the question, in my view, is should the citizens of Oregon have an opportunity to pick what is a different rational approach to excluding evidence? And that is the approach taken by the United States Supreme Court, at least to the extent that the United States Supreme Court has taken a rational course. I think referring this to the people to vote on is an appropriate thing to do. Now, it may be that the people's vote is essentially a vote of no confidence in the way the Oregon Supreme Court has handled the exclusionary rule. And if that's the case, I guess my response to that is so be it. So essentially, what I'm here to testify to is that the truth is a value we should regard highly, as well as our other values, and that the Supreme Court has taken a rational approach and that the people should have an opportunity to vote to determine which approach is more appropriate in this state. Turning to a couple of other things that I would like to clarify, having heard other testimony in front of you, Senator Bryant's not here, so I can't address that. The Attorney General indicated concerning House Joint Resolution 91 that a California case overturned similar legislation. In fact, the California case upheld similar legislation, and I'd be happy to leave that cite here for the committee. Florida has also passed similar legislation. So to the extent that these have been successfully challenged in other states. I found no case where it has been successfully challenged in another state. I'd be happy to answer any other questions concerning any other provisions of this amendment, but I knew those were the most controversial.
I'm just looking at the language of HCR 91A growth.
Let me
in your
that.
Opinion, is this written in the best legal manner?
The best legal manner.
Well, let me put it this way. The clearest legal manner that it could be written in?
Well, there's always room for clarity, Senator Brown. I think that, I mean, I don't think there's any lawyer who reads this who doesn't understand what it says. Maybe there are. My concern about the Attorney General, I guess the way I'd answer it is, does the Attorney General make a better response when they redraft it? And my concern about that would be that they seem to eliminate the exclusionary rule entirely. Forever and always in the state of Oregon. I'm not sure whether that's necessarily, maybe it's clearer, whether it's a better course, I'm not convinced of. Not sure that exactly answers your question.
Yeah,
you're asking me if you're asking me to redraft this, I haven't taken a crack at it.
No. Mr. Chair, I guess what I was looking for is whether you thought that it was sufficiently clear that we won't be stuck in court proceedings, and obviously that's regarding the interpretation of the Measure 91, and I guess I'd ask you the same question.
I think every one of these things will be litigated vigorously, and will go to the Oregon Supreme Court ultimately, which will ultimately determine its constitutionality. I think if the Oregon Supreme Court feels as if its constitutional authority is threatened by this as drafted, in other words, that this is unconstitutional, I honestly don't think the Attorney General's revision is going to resolve that particular problem. I mean, if the Oregon Supreme Court has to determine whether the exclusionary rule is a constitutionally required remedy, they haven't done that. But either way, either of these bills will force them to determine whether it is or not. And if they determine that it is, I think both will fall. And if they determine that it is not a constitutionally required remedy, which I think is probably the appropriate result, then I think both will stand.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, this is Nelson. We've had testimonies, but this is the chief that has a comparison of what states have the laws. And 87 seems to be completely across the board, but 88, 89, 92, 93, and 94. Do you have any?
I haven't seen the chart. I wish I could respond. You did ask it exactly. I mean, I know what the laws are in these states, so I'm just assuming that the chart may be accurate. But the distinction between what are victims' rights and what are victims' rights is often a very confusing thing for people to draw. And I think the rule of thumb that I use is, does this law assist victims in the criminal process, either in determining the truth or in getting them a right of participation that furthers the pursuit of the truth? And I noticed, Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, that Senator Nelson was particularly curious about House Joint Resolution 88. And to be honest, I can think of no published policy that should prevent a jury trial from occurring. There, I mean, if you believe in jury trials, a jury trial is a good thing. So to the extent that there is opposition about giving any party in any kind of a proceeding that occurs in court a jury trial, I'm baffled by that one. Because if public policy says jury trials are good things, then the community should decide guilt or innocence in any case.
I had a question.
Senator
Nelson. I just said you were talking about Senator Bryant wasn't here, but it was a question you didn't answer.
Oh, question I...
Oh, yeah, you could ask... Excuse
and
me.
I apologize for jumping back and forth. I'm in two committees at once right now.
I'm not offended, sir. I know you're a busy man.
Stepping out to vote in the Rules Committee.
Let's see if I can find it. Yeah.
I like this committee.
Oh, you asked a question about speedy trial, Senator Bryant, and there is a clear answer to your question, which is that the victim's right to speedy trial is a lesser right than the criminal defendant's right to due process and right to fair trial. And in fact, there's a federal case out of the District Court of Oregon that implies as much. It wasn't necessary ultimately to reach a decision, but to the extent that the court addresses that issue, there is a clear answer there.
To me, that would be the only logical conclusion, but I was just hoping to get it on the record that
that's true.
The defendant's right to a fair trial would prevail.
Absolutely, and that is the appropriate answer as well as being the answer.
Thank you.
Just to follow up on a question I asked some of the AAGs earlier about the right of witnesses to testify at trial, and I prefaced that I don't see the room with the fact that at least in the trials that I've watched, a few of the DAs and Loma County have done a fairly good job determining which witnesses should testify and that sort of thing and presenting their cases, and I guess do you think that it should be the DA or the prosecuting attorney's decision determines who testifies at trial? Or do you think that should be left up to the victim whether he or she testifies?
Well, I think I have mixed feelings about that. So if you're first asking me, do prosecutors always do exactly what they're supposed to do? The answer is no. And I was a prosecutor, so I didn't say that with some impunity. Should victims have a right to testify in a criminal proceeding in which they were victimized? I think the case in point that might be most illustrative is the case in Los Angeles where, and I wish I could remember his name, but the black man was beat by the Los Angeles police, and it was videotaped. You remember that? And the prosecutor elected not to allow the victim to participate in that trial or to tell the jury what happened, and not surprisingly, the person was acquitted. So I think my sentiment is the victim is a person harmed. Legally, of course, we say the state's the person harmed, but the victim is a person harmed, and to the extent they have some relevant evidence to share, I think that it would be inappropriate for the district attorney to exclude them from that process.
What about those scenarios, for example, the victim happens to be a prostitute or whatever, and her or his testimony hurts the case?
Well, I think we shouldn't get in the business of judging what a worthy victim is or what an unworthy victim is. I mean, 20 years ago, we could have said, what if the victim was a woman as opposed to a prostitute or a child? Should they, right, or a black person, should we exclude them? I think clearly the answer is no. I think the whole victim right law movement in the United States is essentially establishing victims as quasi-parties in criminal cases. I mean, it's happening. I mean, it's happening, or I wouldn't have a book about it. And so within the context of that, my answer is I think victims who are injured have a basis to participate to some degree. They shouldn't be shut out of the process. Obviously, a victim shouldn't be able to go in and testify about something that has nothing to do with the criminal case at all, but to the extent that their testimony is relevant, I question whether prosecutors should be able to exclude them from the criminal courts. Yes?
Sir, another question on Resolution 87, the right to refuse to interview a deposition of discovery on discovery with that again.
I'm glad you asked me that because I don't know if it was misinformation or just not deep information. The truth is that a common law, meaning the law we inherited from England and that lived here before legislatures started passing statutes, and throughout Oregon's history, a defendant has never had a right to interview a victim or to depose a victim. And in fact, Oregon case law under the Oregon Supreme Court has limited strictly what, if any, discovery can be obtained directly from a victim. For example, in State X Rel Norblatt v. Beach, it was said that once a homicide victim's home was released back to the family, that the court had no authority to order that it could be looked at again. It simply had no jurisdiction, and that's good case law today. So on this point, I think the important thing to note is that the way it's drafted, or perhaps the way it's been discussed, would lead one to believe that, in fact, you used to be able to interview a witness. You used to be able to take their deposition. You used to be able to discover things directly from the victim. I mean, you can't order a victim to take a psychological examination in Oregon except under extremely narrow circumstances. You can't order their home to be searched when it's been released from the state. There just basically is not a lot of discovery to be had under current law from the victim in criminal cases in any event. So this doesn't represent some revolutionary change in criminal procedure, in my view.
Thank you, Professor.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Mona Simon, for the record, and I brought a picture of my father. He couldn't be here today, so I'm in his honor. He was murdered Mother's Day in 1997 by his girlfriend, Danielle House, because he was going to leave her. And she had used a .22 rifle in a similar circumstance several years earlier, in a shooting incident in the same house with a boyfriend and a girlfriend over those same issues. She has a long history of drug and alcohol abuse, and she had total disregard for her children, who were 4 and 6 at the time, and they were in the room and had to be left alone with my brother moaning on the floor. Dwayne's birthday is tomorrow. I don't get to celebrate that event anymore. Our family's traditions and my brother aren't part of our celebrations and in our holidays and the vacations that we put together, and we would talk on the phone every week, and we would go on vacations. And thank you. Dwayne and I were adopted when we were 2 and 3 years old. So he's been a real touchstone in my only real true family. So we have a stronger bond. And as he always remembered great stories, and as we rode the train from Montana to Walla Walla, and he held my hand, he said, "I would always protect you." And he was my touchstone. We talked about, Dwayne and I talked about the emotional and physical abuse that Danielle House gave him, and that she, in fact, gave him a black eye a week before she murdered him. And we talked about how they needed to get help for their drinking. His death has brought me to an attempted suicide, and when my father learned of the death, 5 months later, he died of a broken heart. When it came time for the trial, I wanted to be involved. I wanted to testify. I mostly wanted to know the truth. And I wanted justice. And I was forced to become a crime victim. I had to learn words that I hadn't experienced before, like homicide, criminal justice system, and evidence. I needed to witness that process, and with the help of the Clackamas County Crime Victims Advocacy Program, I was able to do that. Danielle House wanted to waive her right to a jury trial. The state, at my request, asked for a jury trial, and the judge granted the jury trial pending his bench decision. When the jury was excused to go and deliberate, he ruled on the motion, and he rendered a sealed verdict by the bench. 6 hours later, the jury came back and convicted Daniel House of manslaughter 1 in the first degree with a firearm. On appeal, the appellate court ordered the judge to unseal his verdict, which was not guilty. The judge had, in the meantime, had sentenced Daniel House to 5 years. And that was outside of Major 11 mandates. The release hearing, he released her, a convicted killer. We don't know where she's at. We don't know if she's in the state. She has no post-provision requirements. We have no alternatives. The judge held all the power. And it was evident that the judge had a personal political agenda which was not based on the impartial facts of the case. We're not the only victims in this situation. She is teaching her children how to be violent and irresponsible people. She is not taking any responsibility for her actions. She has taught her children, friends, and family that the moral code of violence is acceptable by our society. She has set a standard that crime victims do not have civil rights. Mostly, she has immortalized the act of picking the right judge as the best defense. I clearly support HJR 88, but I support all 87 through 94 in its entirety to be referred to the people. Crime victims also have constitutional rights just as defendants. The reasons why I support the state's right in a criminal prosecution to a jury trial is a single person deciding the case can be influenced by personal values and principles, media coverage, and political agendas. A jury trial can balance by diversity, ethical standards, political values, principles, and political convictions. A single person can hold undue power untouched by the criminal justice system. A jury will want to do what is right, exercise the truth based on the facts, while a judge puts emphasis on the technicalities of the law.
Thank you.
Mayor Duncan.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I started to ask you, you were talking about the personal political agenda, and I just wondered if you might expand on that just a little bit. I think you were talking about the judge at that particular time.
Yes, and it...
Is this a Clackamas?
The Clackamas County case, State versus Daniel House.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed evident that the pre-sentence investigation was ignored and that the evidential facts that were accepted in the case were ignored, and it seemed that there was a clear political agenda against Major 11 or Major 40.
Other questions?
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to hear the rest of the witnesses on Monday, right? That's
correct, Mr. Chairman of the committee. Yes. All right.
We'll
move everything off.
Put this back on Monday. All right.
Mr. Chairman, a question?
Yes.
The professor made a written statement. I don't believe I saw it. Did he?
No, he didn't. Is it Lucas Park? Is it Lucas Park Law School?
Right.
Okay. No, I guess not.
Mm-hmm.
It's a statement from among us.
If
right.
You want to.
It's my first statement.
Yes,
exactly.
Contact
information.
Sure.
Yeah. Is it 3 o'clock or 1?
1.
Is it 3 or 1?
I assume it's 3.
Because we're going to sessions at 1.
But it's probably worth checking if it's switching.
I don't know.
The
workload is workload submission. So I think if you shot me, should check, because we could be going back to 1 o'clock if the workload diminishes.
Sorry,
but I was doing the other.